right microphones up. So we have Fred Malone here with me, and we're talking about the White House and weird stuff, unusual stuff that happens.
Sometimes unusual, sometimes weird, sometimes funny, sometimes not so funny. Yeah, different things.
Well, give it to me.
Okay, one quick announcement.
Civil
War group from the Marion County Historical Society will be in Veterans Park on Memorial Day with our cannon. And the ceremony at Veterans Park Memorial Day is at 11 o'clock, and we'll be there with our cannon. We'll be firing the cannon a couple of times during the ceremony. So,
speaking of firing the cannon off, did you watch the Queen of England's
No, I didn't.
Oh, it was wonderful.
I wish I would have.
At the very end, though, they bring in these cannon brigades, and they aimed it right at the reviewing stand. Now, of course, they're firing blanks,
right,
but they fire them right at her. I thought, there's stuff that comes out of
those.
Yeah,
right. We always, that's one of the things we try to do is keep people from away from the front of the cannon.
Yeah.
And I want to keep them back at least 100 feet,
Well, they were probably 100 feet away from her, but still, shooting, 6-8 cannons twice at her.
Yeah. Yeah, because even with just a dummy charge, you've got, there's flecks of tinfoil and stuff that come out, and you get fire coming out the cannon, too.
There has to be a wad in there.
Oh, right, absolutely. Absolutely.
Anyway,
that 11 o'clock at Veterans Park here in Marion on Monday. On Sunday, we'll be out at the Caledonia Cemetery at 2 o'clock for their ceremonies out there. And Charlie used to speak there.
Oh, really?
At the Caledonia Cemetery.
Was Charlie a vet?
No, I don't believe so.
He was.
No.
Yeah.
But he was always a featured speaker for the Memorial Day services out in Caledonia.
That's something I've always been reticent to admit, and I shouldn't be, that I'm a veteran. But because I served in the United States Army Field Band, I always thought, I don't have any right to call myself a veteran.
You're still a veteran of the armed services. I tried to get in, and they wouldn't take me. I tried to get in the Navy.
Were you too handsome?
Too handsome, okay. Yeah.
That'll happen.
I was and this was during the Vietnam War, I was a terribly, terribly bad asthmatic.
Oh, yeah.
When I was a kid. And so when I went up to Columbus to take my physical I want to say Fort Hayes. I think that word.
I think that's right.
Yeah, Fort Hayes, been a long time ago. Went up to take my physical. I wanted to join the Navy, and they classified me as 4F. Huh. So
I had an infection. It was an easy infection to take care of, but because I had an infection, I was going to be joining the Army Field Band with a folk trio, and the other two guys had passed their physicals, and they were ready to go, and they failed me, so I had to go back 6 months later, which was kind of interesting because 6 months later, it was in Chicago, and 6 months later was the National Democratic Convention. And as I came out, I, by the way, passed it the second time, but as I came out, they handed me some literature that says, come join us at Grant Park. So I got to live history.
Oh, you did. That day. Boy, you sure did. Yeah.
That was kind of fun. Wow. It wasn't fun.
No.
It was
not
kind
that.
Of unusual. I'm glad I went there, and I did get out before the real trouble hit.
Anyway,
let's go.
Okay, all right. We're going to talk about Thomas Jefferson, start off with Thomas Jefferson. The thing and some of this stuff doesn't necessarily relate to the White House because some of these presidents there weren't any stories to tell, so I've got other information about them. But one of the things I think was interesting about Thomas Jefferson when he was served as president, and he served two terms, his private secretary was Meriwether Lewis.
You got me.
Lewis and Clark.
Oh, my goodness.
Of the Lewis and Clark. Right. So
while they were on their tour?
When Jefferson took office, Meriwether Lewis went in as his private secretary.
Okay.
And so when Jefferson decided that he wanted to have this excursion to find the Northwest Passage, route across the country, the person he decided to lead it was his private secretary, Meriwether Lewis.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He actually chose Meriwether Lewis, his private secretary, to lead the expedition, and Lewis is the one that chose Clark. Clark was had been an associate of his, and was in Kentucky at the time, and so he contacted Clark, and Clark initially didn't want to do it, but Lewis said, "If you'll do it, I'll make you co-captain of the expedition," because right. Lewis was supposed to be the captain of the expedition.
Right.
So that's the way he accepted.
His name has always thrown me off.
Meriwether?
Because I always thought it was a woman then, and that's I was thrown off right then. Meriwether. But Meriwether was a man's name.
Oh, sure, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So anyway, his private secretary was Meriwether Lewis. Thomas Jefferson did not move in to the executive mansion right after the inauguration. In fact, he went home to Monticello for a month before he came back and assumed his duties.
Well, Monticello was probably in better shape.
Well, I would say so, yeah. Although by the time Jefferson took office, the executive mansion was nearly finished. I mean, it was actually livable, much more than it was when poor old John Adams and
still had a
Abigail had to go there.
Probably still had an outhouse, though.
Well, not for long, because I think eventually, you know, Jefferson came up with the water closet idea with the natural flow of water from above, and so they put tanks on the roof of the White House and had the old chain toilet, you know.
Yeah, because they didn't need those anti-aircraft guns.
No, not there now. Yeah, right, exactly. Thomas Jefferson's grandson, James Madison Randolph, was supposedly the first child that was born in the new executive mansion.
Why do you say supposedly?
Well, again, this is history that was written in 1802 or 1803, so as near as they can tell, unless someone else was born like a slave child that they didn't know anything about,
I got you,
he was the first child to be born in the White House.
Okay.
However, three children born by a slave by the name of Edith, or Edie, she was known as Edie to Jefferson, was living in the White House, or the Executive Mansion at the time. She had three kids that were born in the White House.
Now,
his grandson.
Is it indelicate for me to ask, were they his children? Or does anybody know?
It doesn't say that they were his.
Okay.
Most of his children were fathered by Sally Hemings.
Okay.
But this Edie had been a part of the Jefferson family for years. So that's why she went to the executive, I keep calling it the White House. I should call it Executive Mansion until we get down the road.
Okay.
But she was one of a handful of house slaves that went with him when they moved into the Executive Mansion.
And a lot of people that try to justify that slavery wasn't that bad bring up things like there were slaves that were really well treated.
Oh yeah,
but they were still
sure
owned.
They were still owned,
and they had to do exactly what.
Yeah,
they
if
told.
You were if you were a house slave or house servant, obviously you were treated much better.
Yeah,
you had good clothes to wear. For the most part, you wore shoes. Most of them did have quarters in the executive mansion.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't, you know, living in shacks on the plantation. So, yes, they did have it better than most. However, they were still owned. And if they did try to escape, they were sought after and brought back. So, it wasn't a great life.
Right.
Far as we know, there are no records to say otherwise, Sally Hemings never lived in the executive mansion.
Why not?
Kept her down on the farm, I guess.
Okay.
It doesn't really say. So of all the children that supposedly were fathered by Jefferson with Sally Hemings, and there were quite a few, they had to be fathered while at Monticello.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because she never.
Well, I'm sure he went home quite often. Monticello is a beautiful place.
Oh, yeah. And really not that far of a trip.
No,
I mean, when you think about the location, I mean, of course, a lot closer now.
So, yeah, by horse.
With automobile. But still, even on horseback or by carriage, it wasn't.
A few hours.
Yeah, it wasn't that far of a trip. Yeah. So that's about all I've got on Jefferson. Now, James Madison, of course, he came after Jefferson. don't have a lot of stories about his actual living in the White House, but some things that are kind of interesting that occurred. On August the 14th of 1814 at 7:30 p.m., the British sailors, led by Rear Admiral George Cockburn, and there were 50 sailors in all, smashed windows, soaked rags in oil, and then set the executive mansion on fire.
Yeah.
And it was totally gutted.
Yeah.
I mean, it was totally gutted. There was nothing left but the shell. Now, not only did they burn the executive mansion, but they burned several other buildings in Federal City, which, by the way, wasn't called Washington yet.
It's called Federal City?
It's called Federal City.
Ah, interesting.
It's called Federal City. I think the only building that was actually left standing was the post office building.
Jeez.
So for a long time, all of the official business of the federal government was conducted in the post office building. It was the only one that was spared.
And it was only 60 sailors?
50 sailors.
50 sailors, yeah, 50 did, sailors all that
that did all that destruction. Right.
Why couldn't they stop them?
Well, apparently the soldiers that we had were not stationed in and around Federal City at the time.
Oops.
And, of course, you know, the War of 1812 was going on, so they were in other places. Most of the fighting was taking place up in the New York area or further west. So apparently they just didn't have the soldiers to combat them. So, yeah, they completely devastated the city.
And the president's wife saved the picture of Washington?
Yeah, that and that's part of the story. one thing about this whole thing, even though they set the place on fire, it took a while for it to completely burn out.
Well, it's made out of stone. It's not going to burn the outside.
Yeah, and so, but one thing, this Rear Admiral Cockburn would not let his men loot.
Interesting.
So nothing was taken, nothing was looted from the White House. Things were taken out and saved by the house staff, the slaves, and so forth. Yeah.
Huh.
So nothing got looted. By morning, only a shell remained. The Gilbert Stuart painting of George Washington, which we all are familiar with, was actually salvaged. And, you know, Dolly Madison is given credit for saving that painting.
Yeah.
She was there.
Okay.
But she was directing what was to be done.
I got you.
Because the size of that painting, Paul Jennings, who was Jefferson's personal manslave or manservant, who helped him dress in the morning and
yep.
had been with him his entire life pretty much, him and a gardener actually took the painting out of the frame. Now, they didn't take the frame down.
No, didn't too they heavy. Cut it out?
Yeah. They took a, yeah. the gardener brought in a hatchet, and they used a hatchet to cut the canvas out of the frame.
Hatchets were a lot sharper back then.
and then rolled it up and put it in a waiting carriage with Dolly in it, and went to the other part of Virginia, across Potomac River, went into Virginia. And that's where they set out the rest of the loot, the destruction of Federal City.
Amazing.
And they didn't come back until, I want to say it was 5 days later.
Oh, so they did come back fairly soon.
They did come back, right. Oh, I think okay. It was like 5 days later after all the soldiers. By that time, more soldiers had moved down from New York and from the northern states and moved into Federal City and finished the destruction of the city. So the city basically had to be rebuilt. Yeah. Restoration on the actual federal or the actual White House or Executive Mansion didn't start till 1815. Now, Madison, one of the places that was not destroyed was Octagon House, and that was a private residence.
Oh,
and so that's where the president and Dolly lived until the restoration was completed of the White House.
Is it still standing?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
oh, I'd like to see that.
Yeah, Octagon House. I don't think it's too far from where the White House stands.
What is the place
today.
Right across the street from the White House where all the executives?
Oh, that's.
I've been in there. I can't remember the name of it.
It's where Truman lived when the White House was very
right.
done.
That's right.
Oh shoot, I can't.
Well,
I just drew a blank.
We as a soldiers' chorus. As we sang in
Blair House.
Blair House, yeah. We sang in Blair House for some executive, and I don't remember, some foreign executive.
Yeah, well,
I
that's
remember who it was.
Typically that's where they put the foreign dignitaries that are visiting the White House.
We got to stand at the base of a stairway, and it was beautiful sound.
Oh, yeah.
And those buildings have huge ceilings.
I've never been in it, but I've seen pictures of it, of course.
Anyway.
All right. So anyway, that was Madison's forte in the executive mansion. And again, we can thank Dolly and Paul Jennings. And by the way, Paul Jennings was an educated slave. And Paul Jennings kept a diary, and it has been turned into a book. And I've read the book, and it's a very interesting book. He was quite an individual in his own right, and of course, eventually got his freedom. Mm-hmm. But for people that are interested in American history, and especially black history, they should learn about Paul Jennings.
How did he get educated? I thought that was against the law.
Well, Jefferson saw to it.
Ah.
Because he was Jefferson's personal slave.
Gotcha.
So he provided him with books. He taught him to read. And if I'm not mistaken, he did get some formal education later on in life. I want to say he was maybe through Georgetown College.
Okay.
But it's a very interesting book, and a very good read.
Georgetown College. Some great bars. That's all I remember over there.
Now, I can tell you about the ones on Court Street and State Street in Athens, Ohio. But okay, John Quincy Adams, son of John Adams, loved to entertain and have people to the Executive Mansion. There was constant parties going on when John Quincy was in the White House.
I didn't know that.
He loved having people around. Their annual New Year's reception would attract several thousand people. Several thousand people. Now, again, you have to remember, in those days, too, the White House was an open house.
Anybody could go.
Yeah, so you didn't necessarily have to be invited by the President of the United States. You could just drop by.
I don't know that there was a lot of room for 1,000 people inside, but I suppose it spilled out.
I'm sure it had to spill out on the lawn. Yeah, no doubt about it. They had a biweekly levee. You know what a levee is?
Yeah.
That's like a party.
Yeah.
And a reception that was very popular.
Bi-weekly?
Holy cow. I told you, you like to entertain.
Yeah.
That was bi-weekly and attended by a couple hundred people.
Huh.
Yeah. And those were invited people.
Yeah.
Those were invited people. Levy, they were invited. Their dinners would typically last from 6 o'clock to 10 o'clock. So they had four-hour dinners with different kinds of fish. Flesh, which would be beef, fowl, duck, canvasback duck, as a specialty. That was one of their specialties, canvasback duck. And, of course, for drink, every possible drinkable drink under the sun, including port, cider, clarets of different kinds, sherries of different kind, burgundies of different kind, champagnes, and the best Madeira that money could buy.
Really?
All at these dinners.
All very old drinks.
All very old drinks, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
If you talk about Madeira.
Go try to find Madeira today.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard to find
port.
It's good,
even.
Right, yeah, right. You're lucky if you can find that.
By the way, is a fortified red wine.
I guess my son, I should say that for people who don't like, you know, who don't know that. So he liked to party. They liked to entertain. They were very entertaining people. And I think that came from the fact that he spent quite a bit of time abroad as well, because he also served in the courts of both England and France,
right,
as an ambassador, kind of taking
his father's spot. Boy, that would have cost a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
Holy cow.
Now, you also have to remember that there was the Congress did not federally subsidize the keeping of the executive mansions.
He did?
The presidents had to do it.
Oh, so he paid for them.
They had to do that on their own salary.
More power to them.
Or their own money. Yeah, or their own money, right. He left the executive mansion a very disgruntled and sore loser because he lost to Andrew Jackson.
Sore loser.
So he did not attend the inauguration. Kind of sounds a little familiar.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's pretty familiar.
Choosing instead to ride his horse alone along F Street in Washington, in Federal City, where he had lived just before entering the Executive Mansion.
Sounds like a basketball player I had. We lost in the first round of the NCAA tournament, which we were supposed to go all the way in, and he walked along. In Dayton, he walked along the river there for About an hour.
Very disgruntled.
Yeah, that's, I guess, a good place to go if you're disgruntled.
Sounds to me more like a recent president we had.
Yeah, well, that too.
Of course, John Quincy was known for liking to swim in the Potomac River naked.
Yes, you told me that last week. Last time.
In fact, on his inauguration, on the morning of his inauguration, he had snuck down to the Potomac to take a swim and, of course, disrobed on the shore before going in. And one of the local reporters for whatever paper was popular back then, I don't know whether it was the Washington Sun or what, Post or what then, but anyway, took his clothes and hid them and wouldn't give them back until she got an interview.
Oh,
was actually a female reporter until she got an interview.
That's pretty brazen.
Yeah, and then she tossed his clothes to him so he could come out of the water.
And this was the early 1800s, so there weren't cameras around.
No. You'd have to make a quick sketch.
Yeah, I guess.
He nearly drowned once while canoeing on the Potomac River with his son John and a young servant.
It wasn't the weight of his clothes that dragged him down, was it?
Well, I don't know whether he was dressed or not in a canoe. I'm hoping, since he had two young kids with him, he had his clothes on. But the canoe actually tipped over, and they had to struggle to get back in the canoe, or all three of them would have probably drowned, and that would have been the end of his term.
All three of my children can give you similar stories about their dad in a sailboat.
In a canoe?
No, in a sailboat.
In a sailboat. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I used to do some canoeing years ago when I was younger with a buddy of mine, and I was always fearful when I went with him because I weighed about 130 pounds and he weighed about 260 pounds. And of course,
like you and me, Ben.
If you understand a canoe, that's not very good weight displacement in a canoe. So that's pretty much the end of John Quincy. Then, of course, Andrew Jackson,
happened to John Quincy Adams?
He eventually got elected to Congress.
Oh, did he? Okay.
Yeah, and he spent several years in Congress. In fact, there was a book out not long ago, and I can't remember the title of it now, but he liked to create havoc while he was a member of Congress. After having served as president and being, you know, rejected from the office by Andy Jackson, he's pretty disgruntled. So he caused a lot of problems in Congress. But there was a book written several years ago about some of his exploits were included in this book. But that's when they had canings, where a congressman would get upset with another congressman. They beat him with their cane.
Right.
They carried pistols in there. They would shoot off pistols into Congress. In fact, they called it I think the name of the book was something like The Dark and Bloody Congress or something like that. Uh-huh. But he was a congressman for a number of years. Yeah, after that, yeah.
Interesting.
Yep. Andrew Jackson, they referred to as the people's president. He was very, very, very popular. Of course, he was so popular because he won the Battle of New Orleans.
Yeah.
Which basically ended the War of 1812, even though the treaty had been signed 4 months before. So Andy was fighting battles even after the war was over.
Yeah. It sounds a little bit like the end of your favorite president that you want to meet.
Jimmy Carter.
It sounds like a little bit like
getting on the plane and flying over to get the hostages. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so that was – he served – I don't remember how many terms he served, but he served for quite a few terms in Congress after that. The only U.S. president ever to be elected to Congress after having served as president.
I was going
to
say, I had never heard of that before.
No other president ever did. In fact, I can't even think of another president that had another political office after they served as president.
Well, now there's a lot of talk that Trump might be selected as the Speaker of the House if the Republicans take over. And that's never happened, I don't believe, has it?
I don't know how that could happen unless he got elected to Congress.
Maybe it's not Speaker of the House.
He'd have to get elected to Congress in order to become Speaker.
No, it's not Speaker. It's an office that you can hold.
Because Nancy Pelosi is Speaker of the House.
I think you can be nominated to be Speaker of the House without being a member of Congress.
Really?
Yeah, I think you can be independent. Oh,
that's part of the Constitution. Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to have to touch on that.
I'm pretty sure that's true.
I'll look that up for the next time.
Okay, good.
Okay. All right, moving on. Andy Jackson, people's president.
Yep.
Of course, there's a lot of controversy over his wife. Rachel. I don't know how to really handle this. Rachel had been married previously.
Okay.
And was divorced.
Okay.
At least she thought she was divorced.
Oh, no.
But apparently the divorce had never been finalized. So when Jackson married her, she technically was still a married woman.
So he was a bigamist.
So they had to go back through the courts and get that righted some way.
Yeah.
And I don't know the story of how that'll happen. But anyway, so by the time that he was elected president, they actually were married. So she never lived long enough to go to the White House. She died. And he always credited distress on her from people that were so horrible to her.
Yeah.
They called her a whore and everything else.
Yeah.
It was absolutely horrible. For slandering his wife, one Charles Dickinson was sent to his grave, and Jackson was left with a bullet in his chest that would stay there for the rest of his life. It was very near his heart. So they had a duel. Hmm. And, of course, dueling was allowed back in those days, as long as it were conducted under the rules of the Marcus, whatever his name was, of Queensberry, I think it is. So both were shot, but this Charles Dickinson, who was the one that slandered Rachel, died. And Jackson carried a bullet next to his heart for the rest of his life.
Huh.
During his inauguration, there was a huge crowd, probably bigger than what Trump had.
Okay.
And
a little political input there.
And a big party occurred afterwards at the Executive Mansion, which got very rowdy, got totally out of hand, and the entire Executive Mansion was trashed on the inside. Furniture was broken, rugs were spilt stuff on, torn up. Things were carried out of the house as souvenirs.
And there wasn't even a rock and roll group that went in there.
No, it was just a bunch of rowdy, probably a bunch of rowdy Tennesseans that came up to celebrate the fact that their buddy Andy Jackson had won. He was just a very, very interesting individual. His vice president at the time was Martin Van Buren. And at the National Jockey Club, Van Buren was riding a horse that broke loose and charged, threw Van Buren off. Jackson stepped in front of the horse and pulled Van Buren away, telling Van Buren to get behind me so he wouldn't be killed.
My. Now, that doesn't sound... I never thought of him as a noble president.
Jackson?
Yeah.
Most people don't. But apparently he liked Van Buren well enough to save his life.
Huh. Yeah, now, he wasn't a very well-educated president,
no,
was he?
No, not particularly, no. He had a very famous White House dinner, and I'm going to have to refer back to the book because it was too much for me to remember.
Sure.
That occurred while he was in the White House.
No problem. We'll vamp over here while you're doing that. go ahead.
Oh. Didn't do anything there, did I?
No. It's me.
Attending this informal White House dinner with the widower Jackson and several guests in 1834, a Pennsylvania lawyer found a table very splendidly laid out and illuminated. He noticed a chandelier above that held 32 candles and other candles on various surfaces around the room. He and his fellow guests sat down with their host at 6:30 p.m., and then came one sophisticated course after another. The first course was soup in the French style, then beef bouillier, next wild turkey, boned and dressed with brains, after that fish, then chicken, cold and dressed white, interladen with slices of tongue, and garnished with dressed salad, then canvasback duck and celery. Afterwards, they had partridges with sweetbreads, and last but not least, pheasants and old Virginia ham.
We're not going to have dressed tongue at the president's thing next
year. No, but I'm going to suggest that maybe we have it next year.
Oh, God.
All of this was accompanied by select wines, sherry and port for the soups and for the meats, then Madeira for the turkey and the fish, champagne for the later fowl courses. Then came the desserts, jelly and small tarts, followed by Blanche, Mode, and Kisses, with dried fruits in them, and I'm not sure I know what that is. Then preserves, followed by ice cream, grapes, and oranges, and then claret for a final dessert.
And all paid for by the president.
Here, celery was a meal for anybody to remember for some... Here, clearly, was a meal for anybody to remember for some time to come. And the only way to possibly enjoy so much food was by the mythology proposed by Jackson's French servants. So he had French servants that laid this all out. That is, to move the courses on and off the table quickly, thus affording the diners mere tastings of each offering. So they didn't have four deets for everything. The meal took until 9 o'clock that night. The Pennsylvania lawyer later recalled, and afterward, that the party retired to a drawing room where the guests sipped coffee and then liqueur while the ladies played the piano and sang. The party ended at 9:30.
Some party. I've been to some good parties, but that... I like food at parties, and that sounded like it had a lot of food.
Yes, it does. Martin Van Buren. Martin Van Buren, of course, was vice president for Jackson, as we just said.
Yep.
And I'm going to refer now to the notes that I made here.
Okay.
On Van Buren. He was... he was kind of a dandy, I guess, would be probably the way I would say it. The gold-plated spoons that he found in use at the White House in his own pretty, tapering, soft, lily-white fingers were the subject of a famous and scathing congressional speech in the early 19th century.
He had dainty fingers?
Dainty fingers.
Okay.
Yes, dainty fingers, well, and he used gold-plated spoons, yeah.
Trump didn't have anything on him then.
The butt of Whig Congressman William Ogle's gold spoon speech was Martin Van Buren, a widowed father of four sons who indeed had brought an elite and elegant air to the presidential mansion in comparison with his more plebeian predecessor, Andrew Jackson. And it was Van Buren's unfortunate lot politically to preside over the nation's first real depression.
Yeah.
He first cleaned house by auctioning off the more worn or gaudy of the Jackson's furnishings, which mostly had been broken up by that big party earlier. Though Jackson had been his political ally and mentor, he next refurbished or installed all new rugs, new chinaware, new upholstery, and ironically, though the gold-plated spoons that Ogle would soon single out were a legacy from President James Monroe. So he actually didn't bring those gold spoons with him, but he used them. Van Buren definitely did create a more aristocratic, less democratic atmosphere at the White House than Jackson did. He favored a continental menu for his elegant little dinner parties. Little dinner parties. He didn't have hundreds of thousands of people there.
Just 200 or so.
Yeah. He didn't balk at attending the widely ballyhooed wedding of the aging Russian minister to Washington, Count Badescu, to a Georgetown schoolgirl, all of 17 years old.
Oh, lovely.
But then neither did most of Washington society, so that was apparently well attended. One who had dined at the Van Buren White House often enough himself was the famed Pennsylvania orator William Ogle, the same one that complained about the gold spoons. So even though he complained about the gold spoons, he still went to the dinners.
Yeah, of course.
The presidential home glittered with imaginable all the unimaginable luxuries and gaudy ornaments that he could find. Finger bowls, golden knives and forks, silver plates, silver soup tureens, foreign wine cut coolers, golden chains to hang golden labels around the necks of barrel-shaped flute decanters with with stoppers, all came under this Ogle's attack. The food served at the Van Buren White House, of course, would never do do either offerings such as French dishes. Where, oh, where, said Ogle, were all the good old fried meat, gravy, and hog and hominy when Jackson was in here.
But he continued to eat the meal.
But he continued to eat the meal, yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
It sounds like, yeah.
So that's Van Buren. And we do have a Van Buren that's part of our Marion County Historical Society Dinner with the Presidents. It'll be there this year.
Yeah.
So we'll take a look at him if you can. William Henry Harrison came after Van Buren. As we all know, he didn't spend much time in the Executive Mansion. 30 days, exactly.
Was it 30 days?
30 days.
Yikes.
March 4th to April the 4th, 1841. Because his inauguration took place in a cold, wet, windy, rainy day, and he spoke for 1 hour and 40 minutes outdoors with no hat or no coat.
And that did him in.
He caught pneumonia
yeah.
and died on April the 4th of 1841. So not much to tell about him.
Yeah.
John Tyler.
Now, did he die in the White House?
He did. Yep, he died.
Or was it still the executive mansion?
Still called the executive mansion. Yeah, I keep referring to the White House. Actually, let's clear that up. It wasn't really didn't really start being called the White House until Teddy Roosevelt moved in.
Oh, okay.
And he referred to it
so
one day as the White House, and it stuck.
Right at the change of the century.
Yeah. John Tyler took over for William Henry Harrison. He was referred to by the general public as His Accidency.
Okay.
Because it was an accident that he became president.
Oh. Okay. That's kind of rude.
Which I always thought was, it was thought particularly rude. And again, he was one of those people that had been vice president primarily. They didn't figure he'd ever go anywhere else, so they stuck him in as vice president.
Oh, my.
At that time, Charles Dickens had been visiting Washington. And he was a visitor in 1842, and that was just a year before he wrote A Christmas Carol, that he was visiting Washington. And he actually came through Ohio on part of his tour and traveled through up what would have been William Henry Harris's War Road. So he would have skirted Marion.
Lancaster?
No, right up what 23 is today,
okay.
or actually a little over from 23.
Okay,
that would have been the War Road. So it went right through Marion and through Upper Sandusky, and on up 23 to where it 53 turns and goes north into Tiffin. If you know where that was,
sure do.
So he went. Excuse me. He went up that road, went past the Overland Inn, and stayed at the Overland Inn and up in McCutcheonville.
And I think that's still here.
It is. Yeah. It is. It's owned and operated by the Wyandotte County Historical Society.
Yeah.
He wasn't. He didn't talk very favorably of Ohio, especially this portion. He thought we had horrible roads. It was muddy. It was deserty. It was disease ridden.
So what's changed?
Well, not much, I guess. He wasn't very kind. To Ohio on his trip. In fact, he wasn't very kind to the entire United States as far as that part's concerned. He did stay. I don't think he stayed in Marion, but he did stay all night in Upper Sandusky. And he's got some pretty crappy words to say about Upper Sandusky, too. But it was interesting that he did come through this area just before he wrote A Christmas Carol.
Yeah, so in Upper Sandusky, there's probably a plaque somewhere that says he slept here.
Yeah, right, absolutely. He was Tyler was the first vice president to succeed to the office because of the death of a president. He did insist upon being a president in his own right, not just simply a caretaker of the office. And that was in the spring of 1841, as I mentioned. At the time he entered the White House, his wife, Letitia, had given him five children, so they came in office with five kids. But his wife had been a stroke victim and was an invalid. So on most occasion, they used their daughter, Elizabeth, or Lizzie, to preside in place of the mother who could not do that. Then he also used his daughter-in-law, Priscilla, who was married to his son Cooper, and she also acted as a White House hostess. All that changed. Letitia died in the White House. I think we might have mentioned that. And then on September, or she died on September the 10th of 1842. One of his Tyler's other sons, Priscilla, was a stage actress, and she then took over the duties of serving as the White House hostess, or first lady, I guess you would call her really a first lady, more of a hostess. So that's really about all I have on them. James Polk, one of my favorite characters that I love to do. James Polk, of course, was born in North Carolina, but moved to Tennessee at a young age and basically adopted Tennessee as his home state. He did all of his presidential business with the staff of only one private secretary, whom he paid himself. He called the job of president a no bed of roses. When he was elected president, or when he was running for president, he was a Whig, by the way. When he was running for president, he said, "I will only serve one term, period, and then I'm going back to Tennessee."
Well, the Civil War was looming, wasn't it?
Well, there were a lot of things looming, yes, yeah. Right. That was in the 1840s.
Yeah.
There were hints of secession even in those early days, right. He took a morning walk every day and made himself available to anyone and everyone that wanted to talk to him or see him.
Huh.
So the White House or the Executive Mansion door was always open. He once said that he would like to clear his office with a Colt revolver.
Oh, jeez.
So apparently sometimes people coming in there irritated.
Yeah,
or something.
It might have been so, yeah.
He worked 6 days a week from 6 a.m. in the morning until he went to bed at night.
Wow.
He was a workaholic. He left Federal City only four times in his 4 years in office, and those were all on, I guess you would call them, vacations. I don't know.
Well, if you work that many hours in a row, you'd need some vacation time.
Yeah, one time he went to back down to North Carolina because they were having a reunion for his college group. Another time he went to the ocean to spend a few days, clear his head, and I forget the other two places.
Well, he deserved it sounded like. Yeah.
On Saturday, March the 3rd of 1849, Polk cleared his table for the last time and left the White House. The normal inauguration day was March 4th of that year, and it actually fell on a Sunday. And in deference to the Sabbath, the official ceremony to swear in Zachary Taylor was postponed until Monday, the 5th. So for one day...
No president?
Ah, but that's another story.
Yeah, there you go.
The Senate pro tem president at that time was a fellow by the name of Acheson. Huh. He assumed the duties of president for one day.
That's interesting. Now, is he included in the 46 that we now... Nope, he's not.
Okay. He was never included, but he was sworn in for
well,
one day.
He's got to be included, so we really have 47 presidents.
And I don't remember his first name, but year before last, I had Zachary Taylor at our dinner.
Yep.
And I had this Acheson come as a special guest and sit at Zachary Taylor's table, and no one knew who he was other than he was a senator. And I made the announcement that we have the only man that you never knew was president in the audience, and I introduced him and had him stand up.
Did he get a round of applause?
He did get a round of applause. I just knocked my microphone off.
That's all right.
He did get a round of applause.
We're down to 3 minutes anyway, okay. So you can knock your microphones around
well,
all you want.
But he, at that time, if there was a break-in in office, the Senate President pro tem would take the place.
Now, I assume they have patched that type of stuff up.
Right, right. Now, of course, it goes from president to vice president, speaker of the House, and
right.
Down the line. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a long line.
It is a long
yeah,
line.
Yeah, I
right.
think it goes back, I think they have like 13 or even further.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So how much time we got?
Well, we got about 2 minutes,
okay.
So you better end something up here.
Okay, well, I can talk a little bit about Zachary Taylor.
Okay.
Of course, he was famous in his participation with the Mexican War. His horse, the only reason why I mention it is his horse, Old Whitey, he brought with him from the Mexican War, and he took to the Executive Mansion when he went there, and so it grazed on the grass at the White House or at the Executive Mansion.
A lawnmower, yeah.
During the summer of 1850, he enjoyed the summer concerts given by the Marine Band. He walked over to the lawn shaking hands with people. On July the 4th of 1850, he took part in the ceremonies at the site of the future Washington Monument, where the cornerstone was being laid, or had been laid, by Polk 2 years earlier. Newspapers at that time noted in their writings that he seemed a little listless that day and his attitude didn't seem very good. Afterward, he returned to the White House. He enjoyed a quantity of cherries and iced milk. And 5 days later, he was dead.
My. What did he die of?
Well, they claim, here's the official definition or the official diagnosis. Okay. He was a victim of cholera morbus.
Wow.
Otherwise known as gastric distress.
Oh, jeez.
So they don't know whether
I didn't know you could die from that.
Well, they don't know whether it had something to do with the heat of the day and the cherries and iced milk or what.
Huh. Wow.
But there was a rumor going around that he was poisoned with arsenic.
Oh.
So, in 1991, he was exhumed to disprove the accusations that he was poisoned with arsenic.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to call it quits because we only got 2 seconds.
Good.
Thanks, Fred.
Good place to stop.
great time.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, LP, Marion, Ohio.